Chris, thanks for joining me here today.
Our pleasure.
Just before we start, could you tell us about your background?
I mean, I guess the stuff you need to know is that I did an economics undergraduate degree, which was really good. But that excited me about sort of applied finance and stock markets. And so I did a master's course in finance and investment, the best investment I ever did in my whole life. That was fantastic. And that fired me up to be a fund manager. I had a sort of a bit of a big problem, though, when I graduated. And that problem was that there were no jobs. Somehow I found something, a small operator, actually a fund which interviewed hedge fund managers in order to sort of construct them into portfolios, a fund of hedge fund managers. Now, I thought this was some strange sort of area to get into, but it was the best start to my sort of working life. Because can you imagine, you know, I'm 22 years old, I'm interviewing these hedge fund gods, trying to work out whether that they're smart or just full of rubbish. You've got to really up your game for that. It was the best two-year learning experience ever. Anyhow, I got my professional exams, all of that gubbins, decided that I wanted to break into proper fund management. And then mildly, rudely, one of the hedge fund guys that I'd met in London, I asked generally for advice, and he offered me a job. Started then as an analyst, and then over time a deputy portfolio manager, and then over time a fund manager. And then I moved, after a few more years, into long only, managed institutional portfolios, topped out at a couple of billion quid, which wasn't too bad. I think did a pretty good job. And then at the age of 39, a few years back, I kind of resigned, and now I've done my own thing for the last 5 or 6 years, which is the most fabulous liberation ever. I still have all of the upside of being, if you like, an institutional fund manager. I probably do twice as much research now on global stocks and things that interest me than I ever did when I was actually working. But I have a much more flexible life. I don't need to be at a desk sort of, I was going to say 9 to 5, but it was more like 6:30 to 6:30 or something back in the day. And bottom line is I just have a lot more fun. So now I consult, I write, I research. Of course, I manage my own money and everything else in between. And it is a much more interesting plural life. And that brings me here, really. You know, a person who sort of seems to have a view on most things, but is still learning. You know, and I generally can say that I am learning so much still each year. And I hope that continues for another 45 odd years.
Do you feel like this is one of the professions or industries where you can be involved in throughout your whole career and still continuously be learning about companies and their strategies and their industry is just continuously learning?
Yeah, I think it is. And that's what attracted me back in the day that, you know, when I was at university or trying to break into the world of work, that's what attracted me. Something where I didn't know precisely what was going to happen each day. I could kind of add value as an analyst or somebody kind of interpreting all the data and information out there. And that's been the case. Here's the problem, though. Here's what I found after, you know, 15 or 18 years in the industry. Just when you kind of rise up the ranks, when you achieve some kind of level of success or seniority, you have a lot of other hassles as well. And that's what ultimately turned me off. I had meeting structures which were appalling, really, when I look back at them. I was doing a lot of things which weren't directly linked with fund management, just because you have to be on certain committees. You know, some of it's important stuff, but it takes you away from the day job. You know, it's ironic that you become good at something or have a good track record, and that puts you into a different world. So I'm really glad that I made the jump 5-6 years ago. I did everything I wanted to do in formal fund management, and now I have this slightly different career where I'm still learning, but I actually get to do all the cool stuff much more than I used to do, which for me is, it's a wonderful liberation. And hence kind of, it becomes a virtuous circle. You then want to learn more. You then push yourself to find out new stuff because you've got the time and the space to do it. And that's really great.
Did you find that at the beginning of your career when you're interviewing all these gods of fund management, did they seem like, or did they give off the impression that they encountered similar issues?
They seemed a discernible life cycle. I think they had extended it because they had moved into hedge fund management, which at that point was very anarchic, for want of a better phrase. It was something where there were no rules, everything was possible, and they kind of loved that. And many of them did extremely well, I'm sure, extremely well financially too. But as in terms of investment returns, very attractive space. Be it via regulation, be it via the application of technology, computers, be it via the fact there are a lot more smart people out there. Some of those, if you like, ability to generate returns have gone away. The industry's become much more rigid, professional, no doubt much more professional, but it's had a rigidity associated with it now, which I think a lot of people find less attractive, certainly me. And certainly when I look back at the sort of the guys who, if you like, when I was interviewing them and now, you know, were the age that I am now, you know, I think they had a little bit more flexibility out there, which doesn't exist so much today. That's not to say you can't have fun in fund management, but I think you've got to be somebody who's sort of happy to work within systems, within structures, within regulatory frameworks, all, you know, useful and important stuff. You have to accept that as a price for playing sort of the fund management game.
Mm. And who's your favorite, do you reckon, out of all the big god fund managers you interviewed?
If I had to pick one, it was the guys that really excited me the most, the guys that, if you like, I learned a lot from, but in a way I want to sort of replicate some of their energy and anarchy, were guys who, not particularly well known, they ran a firm called Scoggin Capital Management out of New York. A guy called Craig Efron was the main guy there. And I remember going to interview him when I must have been 22 or 23. It was my first business trip to New York. Enrolls this guy who's, you know, got this great track record, a real kind of aura about him. And he was just unbelievably friendly, you know, and it fired up in me that actually you can do anything. You know, he was an ex-floor trader. He'd become an event-driven fund manager, an hedge fund manager, and he'd achieved. And what I got from him was that excitement about coming into work, looking for opportunities, talking around opportunities, trying to work out when you're right and when you're wrong, when you've got to cut your losses and when you've got to actually double up. And I learned a lot from those hedge fund guys. That the Scoggin guys really inspired me. But actually, many of them I met, that they were entrepreneurs, they were great thinkers, they expanded my mind hugely. It was the best education. I reckon that versus the very conventional kind of fund management graduate trainee scheme, give me the sort of the excitable, flexible one where I could actually sort of create my own boundaries. You know, I learned so much.
And those, they were brothers?
Yeah, no, there was there were a couple of guys there, Craig and Curtis. They weren't brothers, no, they were colleagues, but you know, many of those teams were very small. You know, they had five or six guys, a couple of senior guys, a few underneath, junior analysts and the like, a few support staff. You know, they were small businesses. But back then in the sort of the mid-90s, and really up until, I guess, the sort of the crisis of 2007, that kind of 10-year period was sort of an exciting time to be involved in that kind of very edgy sort of hedge fund world. Clearly, you know, there were strange things that happened that I came across too, because clearly you can't have excitement, anarchy, energy without there being problems. One of my mild claims to fame, I mean, it's so mild it's hardly worth mentioning, was that you recall Bernie Madoff, you know, the guy who's obviously a huge fraudster in prison. You know, I hate to think how many tens of billions have been lost in his funds. Anyhow, when I joined the hedge fund of funds company, they had an investment in a feeder fund into Madoff. And my job was to run around New York and other locations interviewing hedge fund managers. So I put the request in, can I speak to Bernie? And it was one of those very surreal moments where sort of the intermediary said, okay, I can work that out for you. There are a few conditions, though. One of the conditions was, I forget the precise terms, but basically it was you can only meet him on a Tuesday afternoon. Well, no problem. It has to be after the market's closed at 4:30. Yeah, no problem at all. It has to be in the cafe downstairs from where his office is. I thought, that's a bit strange, but, you know, whatever works. We can have a coffee and a chat. And one final thing, you can talk about anything apart from the fund. And I thought, and I looked at my boss when these sort of criteria came back, and we looked at each other and we said, this fund, it was a marvellous fund. It was 1 and a bit % each month. Clients loved it because it was doing everything that, if you like, diversified hedge funds should do. And we looked at each other and we said, this just doesn't work for us. And we redeemed. This must have been, you know, in the mid-90s. And i.e. many, many years before it all came out, the problems and the fraud and everything else, everything that was basically fictitious. And the funny thing was, we got a lot of hassle from clients. You know, we were selling the best performing fund or the most consistent fund that they had. But what it taught me, And of course, we didn't realize it at the time. We took it on the chin and we found other investments, maybe not superficially as good, but ultimately proper investments. But what I learned from that was that sometimes you just got to do stuff because it's right, because your gut feel is saying, look, I've had all these building blocks of analysis and insights. I've just got to do it. And obviously, the day when it all came out that he was a fraudster and everything since, my old boss phoned me up and said, you know, we were right. You know, we were right all those years ago. We were right, but we couldn't prove it. It was just an instinct. And that's what I like about investments. The fact that, you know, you can be all geeky about it. You know, you can, you know, I've got professional exams and master's courses and whatever else. That's all nice. The building blocks to sort of thinking about fund management, but it's half a science and half an art. And that half artistic bit, that feel, sentiment, insight, experience, just gut feel sometimes, that really matters. And that to me is what proper business should be all about. You know, you can't quantify it to hell. A computer doesn't tell you everything what you want to do. Sometimes a good old human brain, a bit of experience and common sense can really matter.
And do you think, do you feel threatened by the rise of popularity of AI in investing and automated investing?
I'm excited by it in the sense that there are things that AI and computers can be really helpful for in terms of sorting through information, providing you with some proper insights. However, does it take away from the very human world of fund management and the very human world, of course, of investing in businesses? Absolutely not. Trust hugely matters still. Feel, sentiment, you know, the old expression of the market in the short term is a voting machine and in the long term is a weighing machine is absolutely right. In the shorter term, sentiment, fear, greed and everything else still matters, and computers often can deepen that. They can, as we've seen more recently in markets, you know, you think back to that Christmas Eve, US markets going haywire, etc., to the downside. You know, I think that was deepened by computers and deepened by, if you like, some of that quantitative trading. AI I like. I think it's helpful for fund managers, but it can't tell you everything. I still would say that the sort of the qualitative insights, the softer insights, weirdly, they matter more now. Because everyone can kind of, if you like, crunch the numbers at some superficial level, get certain ratios out, sort of get some sort of quantitative feeds, which may or may not be helpful. Everyone's got that. That's pretty commoditized. I think what's better, though, is that if you can actually step aside and say, look, the core group is wrong, the crowd is wrong about something, let me do something different. That, of course, is where you make your money as an investor, when you spot something or feel something different that consensus, you know, has already baked in.
Do you think a computer would have spotted Bernie Madoff in the same way that he...
Probably not. But I think clearly the computer, and we used computers back then to optimize portfolios, and they loved Madoff because Madoff was everything you want. He was uncorrelated, you know, 1 and a bit % each month was wonderfully uncorrelated with other people with real returns that were a bit more all over the place. So, you know, Madoff was a massive computer-generated thumbs up. And therein lies the problem. Of course, when the computer says yes, maybe the human says, well, hang on, has it over-optimized this a little bit? You know, can the past really be a real good predictor to the future? You know, an insight, sure. But to sort of extrapolation, of course, is the most dangerous word in fund management or in finance. And we so easily extrapolate from the past. And sometimes a bit of insight, a bit of thought, you know, in the case of Madoff, you know, when my boss and I were told, you know, that wonderful line, you can talk anything apart from the markets, you know, that was the massive red flag that you just don't feel comfortable. And a computer wouldn't have told you that.
Yeah. Do you think... companies that are sort of too perfect, or funds that are too perfect in a computer generated sort of analysis, do you think that's a red flag for you?
Well, you know, some companies for years and years do have better margin than competitors, better returns on capital, quantitative stuff, which sort of a computer would highlight as being an outlier. You know, there are always companies that can do that. I think the role of the analyst, the role of the fund manager is to say, okay, let's be a bit skeptical. Let's road test it. Let's work out whether that's justified. Where I get excited about investments is when I see a management team that I think is skillful, that is highly incentivized, that is doing superficially a good job within an attractive investment theme where there's a valuation I can make work. When I see all of those things put together, I'm excited. You know, that still excites me. A computer can help you with that, But sometimes that final sort of the cherry on top, if you like, is you saying, well, hang on, I heard the CEO speak. I trusted the guy. He seemed to make sense. I like the strategy. Yes, I know the stock is not the cheapest it's been, but I can trust what these people are doing. It seems to me that it's a good strategy, it's a good idea. And that will obviously take you through those sorts of pitches and troughs in market sentiment where everything gets sold out off, you know, in a completely sort of highly correlated fashion. You know, that those insights into investments where you feel as if you've seen something that you like, something you can trust and understand, that's what induces you to sort of buy those investments on, you know, at the end of last year or just before Christmas when markets generally were very under pressure. And perhaps a computer alone would not tell you that.
Hmm. And so if you're looking at a company, how long does it take for you when you first start looking at a company before making an investment decision, do you think usually?
Typically, I would say, well, it's taking a step back is obviously an ongoing process. But in order to, from sort of the get-go, for me to actually start to invest, I would say it would be a deep dive on the numbers. You cannot beat primary research. And the best way to start with a company is when you get a set of numbers published. You know, half-year numbers, full-year numbers, whatever it might be. Get those numbers published and get all over them. In today's world, we're very lucky. You know, back in the day, we had to sort of scrape around for bits of information. But in today's world, websites have a bunch of useful stuff on there. Webcasts, presentations, and obviously the detailed numbers. Get all across those. And basically ask yourself a few basic questions such as, do I understand the theme and the basic general structure of the business? Is it attractive to me? Could I see that this could be a good place to invest, sort of thematically, big picture? So that requires a little bit of macro awareness, I would say. Then do a dive into the numbers of the company, earnings, cash flow, strategy. Listen to how the tone of the management. You know, I think people woefully underestimate the importance of listening to management speak because you can pick up so much from hearing their voice. You know, it's a bit like you can get a transcript of something and it's sort of useful and insightful, but you then hear somebody speak it and then you think to yourself, hang on, that's kind of even more insightful, even better if there's Q&A, you know, not just what the questions people are asking, you know, maybe really skilled analysts of many years' maturity and experience, but also how management teams, they respond to the questions. You know, that's kind of interesting too. The ideal is, of course, I always find you know a company better when you've looked at it already, but I reckon if I do a deep dive into the numbers, if I do a deep dive into sort of things around the numbers, presentation documents, webcasts and whatever, if I think about the macro scene and then do a few basic numbers based on cash flow and earnings and come up with a feel whether I like a company or not, you know, that process can be just a few hours, I guess, because I've done it so many times, I can kind of condense it that way. But for somebody who doesn't have all day to look at investments, I would say take time, look at the primary data, write stuff down, because that in today's world does matter. And if you're not sure, go back to it in 3 or 6 months' time and they have another set of numbers out and sort of say, hang on, they said back then that their margins would be this or that so-and-so region would be their best performer, and it wasn't. And start asking questions. You know, you could even ask a question of the management. You know, you can send an email to the investor relations people or just sort of do it on a credibility basis. Are they delivering what they said they would? Do I trust them? And then obviously then wrap it around things like valuation and other stuff. I think often people start with, oh my goodness, this is a PE of 5. It's got to be cheap. You know, wrong way to look at it. That comes at the end. Start with what the company stands for. Do you trust them? Do you like the strategy? And then fit your valuation stuff to it and your valuation insights into those, into it that way. That's certainly what I do. The valuation, dividend yields, PE, whatever, that comes last. You know, start with what the company stands for and whether you trust it or not.
That's very interesting. A very specific approach to look at the numbers last after you've made those initial judgments.
Yeah, because the thing is, often the original inspiration might be, oh my goodness, they've got a 7% yield, or oh my goodness, the share is down 20%. That's fine as an inspiration, But then start with your fundamentals first. Start with the big picture strategy, then the company strategy, then the management. Do you trust them? Work it all together. Make a few notes. Doesn't need to be War and Peace, but it can be just a page or two of notes, bullet points, any insights you have. Keep those, even if you decide not to invest. And obviously, definitely keep those if you do invest, because you need to then go back to it. You know, when you invest, it's just the start of the process. The ongoing monitoring, and again, you know, wonderful, wonderful tools exist. You know, you guys know all about the tools that exist in order to keep monitoring investments, watch lists and everything else. But doing that is such an important part. You know, I kind of feel like the initial investment decision is like an iceberg. You can only ever see 10% of it. That's just 10%. All of the other stuff is underneath the surface, ongoing monitoring, how it fits into your portfolio, and then hopefully nice questions like, should I be taking some profits here, or should I be doubling up if maybe the share hasn't done quite what you want it to do?
In this ongoing process.
Precisely. I mean, investment, this is why I think back to what we talked about, you know, 10, 15 minutes ago, investment is an experience game, and funnily enough, as you try and dedicate more hours to it, you do get a bit better. And the good news is, you are always learning. And hopefully, though, with a few years of experience, you can stop yourself making some silly mistakes. I still make plenty of mistakes, but I think I've ironed out some of the most silly ones. And now I just make mainstream mistakes. Now, that's just the nature of investments. But what you learn from it, how you react to those situations, that's what makes you a good investor. And an acknowledgement that not everything can go right. I think if you can get a good 7 out of 10 batting average, and control the risks on the 3 out of 10 that have let you down, where your analysis maybe wasn't quite precise, or the exogenous issues that kind of hurt you, then you'll do absolutely fine in terms of as a sort of a portfolio manager, or as, if you like, a wealth generator, if you're managing your own money.
And when you give advice to people, or when you discuss investing to people, do you have to tailor sort of your answer depending on who you're talking to?
I guess so, because sometimes if I speak to regulated people, professionals, then we'll just dive in at the deep end with lots of terminology and other boring stuff like that. But funnily enough, I find when I have to come down, in the nicest possible way, a couple of notches to make it a bit more accessible to a slightly broader audience, I actually find that's when I learn the most. Because the thing is, as the old expression that you really know something if you can explain it in simple terms. I did a presentation a couple of weeks ago, and the audience was a general audience. There were some people who loved investments and some people who it was just their retirement money, and they were there because, of course, naturally they were worried and concerned about that. And I gave an overview about markets and other stuff. And it was actually great fun to do, because I brought it down to sort of an area where everybody could understand it. And I was doing a little bit of Q&A afterwards. And the most people that were most excited in asking questions were those that self-admitted were not finance geeks. But they'd got a bit fired up by it, because they actually saw it wasn't an impossible area to understand. And they wanted to just extend their knowledge a bit more, ask a couple of questions about, you know, the usual suspects, Brexit and world trade and other matters. And it was great fun to do. So I find that I learn more when I do that. When I'm in, when I'm geeking it out with some, you know, industry professionals, it's all very, it reminds me of, you know, 10 years ago as an institutional fund manager, as a massive geek off based on archaic financial terminology and valuation ratios, which, you know, is all very nice, but after a while it feels a bit unreal. So it's good to have the opportunity to speak to a wide range of people, because that way I think you become a more rounded person, number one. But number two, I think you actually become a better investor.
Very interesting. When you mentioned before, when you listen to management talk and how important that is, you know, the concept that 90% of communication is nonverbal or something along those lines. Do you think that plays a role in your assessment of what management's talking about?
Because investment is a trust game. It's a trust game at so many levels. If we think about it in a very simple sense, when you invest in a bunch of companies, you cannot be there on the shoulders of those management teams 24 hours a day. At some level, you've got to trust them that they're going to employ that strategy they talked to you about at the last set of numbers. Or if something hits the fan, if something gets very difficult, some exogenous issue, macro or whatever else, that they're not going to absolutely panic and do something which actually would not be a good idea for the sort of medium term positioning of the company. So I think a lot of those insights, that feel, that confidence comes from, as you say, if you like, non-financial insights. It comes from this sort of base level, do we trust somebody? And this comes back to the importance of things like webcasts, podcasts, anything where you can actually hear people speak. You know, you can discern something from it. Are they sort of being, just the way they interact with people, the way they answer questions, the way they describe something. What's really interesting is when you go back a year, they've got, you know, a history of webcasts and podcasts on there. You look what they said a year ago, particularly when it's been a bit of a tough time. Then you look today, kind of insightful. You know, I learn all the time from these sorts of things. And I think then the thing is, you need to merge it with a little bit of science, with some numbers, with some appreciation of macroeconomics and related. And as I say, investment is a fusion business. You've got to be part economist, part financial analyst, part psychologist, part sort of sociologist, if you like, as well. Chuck it all together and try and make sort of a view whether the average person is going to be excited by that. Because that's the other business. As investors, we are, you know, even a big institutional investor can just be a marginal player over the medium term. And so when you're a private investor, you know that your buy and sell decisions, unfortunately, not going to have much of an impact. Well, I guess that's probably good news for spreads and stuff like that. But as a marginal investor, you therefore also have to think, well, is this something that I could see progressively bigger investors, other investors getting excited about? And of course, that's the other interesting aspect of investment, trying to work out what the average person thinks, whether what you've seen is not fully discounted by the market or not, whether your insight is something that over the next 3, 6, 9 months, the market is going to sort of become much more aware of. And, you know, private investors think that they cannot get ahead of the curve versus the institutional guys. And my experience of, I guess, being both sides of the fence is that you can. And you do that through actually caring about your investments and doing a bit of work. And just looking at a presentation document, listening to a webcast, believe you me, most institutional investors do not do that. And it seems amazing to say, you might find that their junior analyst did, you might find that their favorite stockbroker did, but the actual investors, they also take stuff on trust. You know, a favored broker or a favored junior analyst, they say, oh, you listened to it, you liked it, let's go for it. And as I say, a lot of decision makers make decisions for strange reasons. For your own decision making, what I say is, it starts with doing a bit of work. Do you trust it? Do you believe in it? Can you make it work numbers wise? Have you written down a few key points so you can go back to them? And then the game starts. And you won't get everything right, but you won't feel as bad about it. You'll at least, you'll be able to look yourself in the mirror and say, I actually tried. You know, I tried to understand it. It didn't work for X, Y, Z reasons. I'll learn that and move on. The worst thing about being an investor is when you take a tip from somebody and you buy it, you're not so sure, but this person said, yeah, it's going to be hot, it's going to be great, and it doesn't work out. You feel terrible because you feel as if you just burnt whatever, you know, sum of money you've lost. You know, far better to do a bit of work and actually say, look, I tried, but I accept this is one of my 3 out of 10 that didn't work. Hopefully the next one is a better one.
And do you think the success of an investment is driven largely by the industry that company's in, or by the fact that their management team has really successfully executed their strategy, or like both?
Yeah, it's always both. It's certainly true that sort of big picture issues, the industry sector you're in, it matters. And as I say, this is why I spend a good proportion of my time looking at macroeconomic issues, because I need to understand whether an economy is going into recession. I need to try to understand what are the big themes out there in terms of the big economic data, or just sort of general financial or social themes. And it is great to be riding a positive theme in your investments. So, you know, that is good. I think it's much harder. And certainly it sort of forces you to look at valuations in a certain way if you're in an industry that's struggling at the moment. For example, I would value and think about a food retailer where clearly there is competition, change and everything else, how I would look at that compared to, let's say, an e-commerce retailer is completely different in terms of the criteria I might use, the valuation ratios I might consider are attractive and everything else. So that's sort of that big picture aspect. But ultimately, management has to employ a correct strategy and has to execute a correct strategy. And we see across both successful and unsuccessful nominally businesses or themes or sectors that there can be a wide range of outcomes. And that then comes down to the right strategy, the right products, the right management team and everything else. So I think investment is a bit of both. It's both big picture and small picture. And you get the best picture by combining those two. So that's what I do. And it sort of seems to work. You know, it isn't easy. And it forces you to try to almost become a little bit of a mini expert in everything. But it is worth it. Because ultimately, you know, you should be putting an effort into your investments, particularly if you're managing your own money. You know, money is hard to earn and easy to lose in the markets. And I think, therefore, you should give it its suitable due deference and kind of, you know, work hard accordingly in order to try to work out what you're doing, why you like stuff, or maybe why you don't like things.
And so if you had to quickly sort of summarize a three-step approach, it would be sort of look at the macro of the industry, look at the company and the management, and then the last step, as you mentioned, then the nitty-gritty financials and the valuation.
Yeah, I would say I boil it down to understand or answer the question thematically why you should like this company. So that's big picture stuff. Second question is, what's their edge? What's their story? Do I trust it? Do I believe it? And the third angle would be partly valuation. Can I make the numbers work? You know, is there a reason, even if it's something simplistic like a P ratio or a dividend yield or a free cash flow yield, can I see something which makes it attractive to me and importantly, potentially other investors too? And obviously that may require, again, thinking a little bit bigger picture and put it in the context of wider stock market valuations, or maybe things like the bank account. You know, if you can get 5% in the bank, that's a pretty good hurdle to get over. At the moment, obviously, the hurdle from cash in the bank is negligible, which means that you should imagine that many investments should be looking quite interesting.
And you mentioned right now the interest you get from a bank is negligible. Where do you think we are currently in the macroeconomic cycle, the general period of time we're in, where it's sort of unprecedented low interest rates? Where do you think we're at now?
Yeah, it's, you know, as an insight, you would say, my goodness, the world is therefore troubled. For me, it's a corollary to the fact that we've got a lot of debt in the world. And as a consequence, be it government debt, be it personal debt, be it corporate debt. And as a consequence, there's a sensitivity to higher interest rates. You know, the Federal Reserve in America had a go at raising interest rates over the last year or two. They seem to have pulled back a little bit from it. Other places, Japan, Europe, even here in the UK, we've struggled to justify any, you know, material interest rate increases. In fact, you know, some bonkers places like Japan, they've had, you know, a generation of ultra low interest rates. So I think that's telling you something about debt in the world. And that therefore tells you something about economic cycles and the type of company you want to be looking at. Whenever you've got debt, high levels of debt, you get two things. Number one is you tend to get more volatility because, of course, in equity markets, the biggest, if you like, impediment, the biggest negative for them is debt. You know, debt comes ranks before equity. Debt is the thing that compresses your equity return the most. And so therefore, I think the value of equities is therefore going to be much more volatile depending on whether people are, you know, temporarily excited about the world or temporarily disappointed about the world. So I think that means that we're in an era where stock picking and stock selection is good and positive and a useful sort of function to do, a good source of potential returns, but also one where you need to be very much aware of what your company's doing. So what I'm looking for, what I'm focusing on, are companies with strong cash flow, because cash flow gets you out of jail. Even if you've got a bit of debt, cash flow can get you out of jail. If you don't have debt, cash flow is the source of dividends and innovation because you reinvest back into your business. So if there's one, if you like, method that I'm really focusing on in today's world, it's free cash flow generation. So, you know, simply put, cash flow from operations minus CapEx equals free cash flow. What you do with that, pay dividends, buy back shares, reinvest even more back into your business, do M&A, pay down debt, whatever it might be. That is your critical insight, I think, to management teams and potentially, therefore, then the value of a business over time. So for me, it's not an easy backdrop, but I'm excited because what I see is a range of different sort of scenarios from companies, some of which are bogging it up because they've got too much debt. Others have actually worked out an interesting area, niche that they're operating in. They've got a great balance sheet. They're generating good cash flow. And because they're paying out dividends or doing buybacks, that sort of remuneration yield back to shareholders is so much higher than bonds, government bonds, corporate bonds, let alone interest in the bank. And, you know, for investors, that is wonderful. It's a different game when you've got 5 or 8% interest rates, because then, you know, your risk-free rate is so much higher. Today, the risk-free rate is much lower, so therefore your opportunity to invest is better. You've just got to be a bit more selective because that backdrop, that environment is not the easiest. And, you know, we haven't even talked about world trade or Brexit or other stuff, which obviously are curveballs into that. But fundamentally, I think it comes back down to debt. And the fact is there's a lot of debt in the world, and that debt level is only going up, not down.
And do you think the media focus on Brexit and world trade and Trump and other political events that are unfolding and the effect it'll have on economics and therefore equities and how they perform, do you think that plays a lesser importance than, say, debt, as we just spoke about?
Yeah, I think it plays a bigger importance short term, because the news flow matters. You know, it's back to this notion that investment, you know, in the short term is a voting machine. And, you know, what better voting machine insights than the Brexit shenanigans, Trump's latest tweet, and related matters. So all of that news flow hugely matters and is hugely influential. And that's why you need to keep on top of that, because that does push investments around. Longer term, It doesn't matter so much on those issues. Clearly, they can have longer term impacts. You know, we could debate what impact Brexit could have on the UK economy, on Trump, on diplomacy, world trade deals. Clearly, yes, all of these things feed into a longer term picture at some level. However, ultimately, longer term, it's issues such as debt, which really do matter, because that is that sort of tells you what sort of environment equity is going to be valued at, how much value equity can add, and related. So always it's a long-term and short-term fusion. So yeah, stay abreast of all the news flow, but try and think about it in a slightly contrarian way, i.e. if, let's say, we have everybody head in hands over Brexit, it's an unmitigated disaster, it is apocalypse, you know, will the last person to leave the UK turn off the lights, and thoughts like that, guess what? That probably means UK stocks are cheap. You've just got to kind of work your way through that period. If Trump says something silly on Twitter, then maybe take the opposite view. You know, if he's saying, I'm going to blow trade up because I hate China, then, you know, clearly that's going to be very messy in the markets over the short term. But just maybe that provides opportunities. So use the short-term news flow to your advantage whilst focusing on the longer-term issues, directions and trends, and bigger issues such as debt, which ultimately, if you like, will distinguish and allow you to understand whether you can really make money in an area or not.
And when you look at news flow and events unfolding, are you always thinking in the back of your mind, how is this an opportunity or how is this going to affect
you? I'm a glass half full guy, so I'm always thinking about it as an opportunity, not a threat. Of course, let's say I have a bunch of, I don't know, UK domestic focused stocks, and there's some, you know, big Brexit news, which may mean that UK growth might be lower over the next 2 or 3 years, that there's clearly an impact there. There's a threat there. But maybe there's an opportunity too, because the market is a wonderful discounting mechanism. It's very quick. You know, we're back to computers again, and people sort of saying, you know, this is what it means in a very categoric fashion. If you can spot where there may be opportunities, where maybe it's gone too far, or conversely, where you know, too much faith, too much hope has been factored into something, you know, as a voting machine investor, you should then say, time to take some money off the table, or with the opportunity, time to put money, more money back in. And that's what I mean. It's this tension between voting machine investor and weighing machine investor. That's where it gets interesting. And that's what always excites me. And if you can sort of just take a step back from the news and spot the opportunity, have that glass half full sort of approach, I think you'll do okay, because ultimately it's good to be optimistic. You know, if you're not optimistic about the world, then I guess ultimately we're not going to be here. Because, you know, the world's all about optimism. The human race is all about optimism. And even though there are times to be pessimistic in the sense that you have recessions and huge uncertainties, as I say, the market wonderfully discounts those quite quickly. And you'll get a massive opportunity where people have just got overly pessimistic. So look for those extremities. But ultimately, the glass is always half full.
And speaking of glass half full, I just swallowed very loudly. When you think about how you're excited about what's going on in specific companies, is there an industry you're really excited about at the moment, or maybe a few companies you're really excited about? You spoke about free cash flow.
Yeah, no, I think for me, when I look at opportunities today, if I couch them sort of big picture first, I would say we are lucky here in the UK, because I do think that the pessimism over the whole Brexit debate, you know, I'm not, I don't know how it's going to work out precisely, but my observation is when I speak with people outside of the UK, particularly a long way from the UK, they think we're bonkers, we're absolutely crazy, this sort of insular Brexit debate. But second, their willingness to invest in UK opportunities is very, very negligible at the moment, which tells me that when the dust settles, when we get a bit of clarity one way or the other, there will be opportunities in more domestic-focused UK equities. And obviously, when you look at the mid and the small caps, they tend to be a little bit more that way. You know, some of the large caps are very export-centred. So I do like UK stocks at the moment, particularly the more domestic-focused ones. I also think that there is emerging markets have got a little bit too cheap. They have recovered in recent months, but I certainly think some of the longer-term positioning some companies have in the emerging markets is undervalued today. And as a final theme, I would say when I look at Europe, people have written Europe off just like they've written the UK off. So I would say that's a little bit rude, and certainly some of the European names I can find opportunities. So I'm focusing my investing at the moment in pan-European opportunities, both domestic UK and the continent and the emerging markets. I'm a little bit shy or a little bit coy of the States at a sort of a geographic level. I think a lot more has been factored in there. There are some interesting US companies, but you've got to be much more of a stock picker there rather than a thematic investor. In terms of a few names to sort of conjure with, I'll just pluck a few out. You know, I tend to be a bit more of a large or mid-cap sort of guy in terms of my focus, just because as a global investor, you know, there's only so much you can look at, and that tends to be that's been my focus for the last 20 years, and I guess will always be that way. So I'll just chuck a few names out that I kind of really like at the moment. I think in the mid-cap space, a company such as DS Smith, SMDS is the ticker, is a really interesting business. They're interesting for two reasons. The theme is corrugated board, which sounds the most boring material ever, until you suddenly realize it's the stuff that wraps up your e-commerce parcels. And of course, that's the big theme. The rise of e-commerce has been wonderful for corrugated board companies. Additionally, a lot of the fast-moving consumer good names, they find that they use corrugated board in order to advertise their products, and that's worked out well as too. It's environmentally friendly, which I think is a big theme. And also, it's an industry that is oligopolizing, which is good for pricing. DS Smith, sort of unfashionable, strange name, has actually been quite savvy in the way they've expanded into Europe and the States to augment, supplement their UK position. They've just announced actually a disposal of their plastics business, which again is in sort of indicative of the sort of the environmental switch, you know, plastics being a little bit more old hat, a little bit less environmentally friendly. They've just disposed of that at a pretty good price, good for the balance sheet. I like the cash flow there. I like the valuation. I like the strategy. I think the management team are savvy. You know, I've heard them speak. I kind of trust what they're doing. It's a stock I like at the moment. So that's one mid-cap name I would conjure with. Thinking emerging markets, I am amazed at the valuation that PZ Cousins, PZC, is on at the moment. Again, a mid-cap name. It's got important, you know, people would know it for things like Imperial Leather or Cousins, you know, soap and related brands that you would use. It's also got a bunch of Saint-Tropez and other sort of fake tan sort of brands, again, which are quite well known. It's been doing a good job with those brands in markets such as Europe, including the UK, even in the Americas and Asia. What's been the problem, though, is that historically they've had a very big position in Nigeria. And that's a market that they've been in for a long time, a market where they've got a big market share, but unfortunately a market where growth has been lower recently. There's been various concerns over the political and economic backdrop. They've just had elections there. There's a lot of fear about where the country is going. In my experience and my observation, too much fear. When I look at Nigeria today, what I see is thematically a very interesting opportunity if you've got a material market position. So when I look today, I think the share price has basically the Nigerian business, the African business, are basically a zero valuation. And I think that's rude. So you've got sort of like a good business elsewhere, cash flow coming off that. They've got a little bit of debt, but I think they've got the cash flow to cover that, push chivvy that down, and pay the attractive dividend. So that's something I can work. I think if you get emerging markets sort of viewed a bit more glass half full, then particularly Nigeria, then PZ Cousins will put on, you know, 20, 30% without even thinking about it. So that's another sort of mid-cap name that I like. If I go sort of larger cap, I'll chuck out a couple of names. My biggest position is actually a company that recently delisted from London, which sounds a bit weird, but I'll explain. We would have known it as London's Randgold Resources, so the world's largest gold company. Today, because Randgold merged with Barrick Gold of Canada, they're now US and Canadian listed. Barrick Gold is the new moniker, the new name, which sounds kind of boring, because why would you want to buy the world's largest gold company? But understand that it's the Randgold management team that are now running it. And my perception is the management team there are hugely value-adding. And what they will do with the Barrick Gold assets, based on what they've done with the Randgold assets, and what they are trying to do with other gold assets in the industry, I think is tremendously remunerative. So if I had to sort of buy a foreign listing name, Barrick Gold, you can buy it in Canada or the States, would be my favourite. But obviously the genesis of my holding is actually Randgold Resources, the London listing, which I held for many, many years until my shares went Canadian a few months ago. So that's one name I would like. If I look at I'll keep it just London listed stuff. If I had to think about one sort of larger cap name that I liked that I thought was interesting, I would say it's sort of a, and this is where themes kind of become a bit messier, because certainly we've talked already about sort of environmentally friendly and positive kind of social and governance themed sort of stocks, things like DS Smith. But when you think about stocks that get a bad name, things like tobacco companies and Imperial Brands in particular, I'm thinking about, I see an opportunity there. I'm not a smoker. People, I think, make their own decisions about these things. It's heavily regulated now and related. But what I observe with Imperial Brands is change. And change because you've got people moving away from cigarettes and into e-cigarettes, vaping, and related newer opportunities. When I heard Imperial Brands talk a few months ago, when I heard them say that they thought at the end of this year, the end of 2019, the gross profit per sort of packet, if you like, per unit of their new style vaping and e-cigarette options would be the same as the gross margin on a packet of core cigarettes, I thought to myself, my goodness, they've really worked out how to make money from these new areas. And even though we know that it has certain demerit aspects to it, consumer choice is important, I think, and people do have freedom of choice, and that's a good thing and should be something to be encouraged. And on that basis, when I look at where Imperial Brands is valued today, I think that's a bit rude, because it is highly cash generative, it's paying an attractive dividend, and I think actually it's got a growth aspect people are underestimating, not just in this country, but globally. So that would be another name which I think is cheap today, but which maybe is a bit sort of left of field, or people have, you know, maybe struggled recently with the story, particularly with the rise of more social and related governance related sort of investment, sort of investing styles. So that's another one I would like. But there are lots of opportunities out there, even in sort of, you know, the hated things like the financial area and whatever. I can see some opportunities, let alone consumer, retail and related. What I like about investments is the stories change all the time. There are always things to be looking for. And it does, as I've said already, it does reward the person who, or the investor who spends a bit of time looking at it and tries genuinely to try to open these companies up and try and work out what the angles are.
It's very interesting that when you spoke about each of these companies, you probably consciously did it, but it seemed to me subconsciously took that three-step approach. You spoke about the theme first, and then the company, and then the management, and then just a little bit about the valuation and the specifics and the financials.
Right, because I think this comes back to, I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's too many years of thinking about these things. It's just become my way of doing things. But I always think, if take it a couple of steps back, people should be, A, passionate about their investments for all the right reasons. You shouldn't fall in love with them, but you should be able to sort of say logically why you like it and why you see opportunity. And if you can do that, that shows that you've done some work, you know, rather than all something very superficial or generic, which you picked up from the newspaper or, you know, your mate down the pub. If you can actually add a little bit of extra colour or value, it shows that you've gone that little extra mile. And the funny thing is, you learn all sorts of interesting facts and insights and whatever from listening to these chief executives or their colleagues talking about the companies and trying to open them up for you. And that really helps when it comes to that difficult point where maybe something's slightly disappointed, markets are volatile or whatever, you're trying to decide what to do. You then go back to all those insights and then you say, hang on, that still works for me. You know, I can still justify that. I'm going to buy some more or whatever the decision might be. Maybe it's to sell the stock. But, you know, the starting point is actually you getting comfortable with it and you making decisions. And the only way you can do that is by doing the work yourself.
Hmm. You mentioned sometimes when valuations are low and you use the word rude. Do you think when you're invested or you're looking or following a company and their cash flows are great and they're reinvesting and they may pay a huge dividend yield or they may have great cash flow, but the valuation isn't quite there yet. Do you wait for them to reward you as a shareholder by dividends, or do you wait for the markets to revalue it? And, you know, how long do you stick with it?
Yeah, I mean, dividends are nice. Everyone loves a dividend, but, you know, I, like most of us, I guess, would be total return investors, i.e. capital gains or losses, you know, do kind of matter. That's part of the equation. And as a consequence, I think you need to be patient. Always be patient. Allow shares to come to you. You know, just because it's paying an attractive dividend yield, let's say it's paying an attractive 4% yield, but you feel the shares are 10% overvalued. Well, you're going to feel a bit of an idiot if the shares come back to sort of your buying level. You have de facto lost 2.5 years of dividend. I know it doesn't quite work out that way, but you get the point I'm trying to make. As from a total return perspective, you know, you've got to be a bit savvy of these things. So I would always say it's nice when there's dividends, and that's part of the investment sort of building blocks and your ultimate decision. But fundamentally, if a share is a little bit rich, it can easily wipe out a year or two of good dividends equivalent as it comes back down to more sensible valuation. So be patient, be a bit picky, wait for shares to come to you. And this is where having awareness of the big scene really helps. Because when you get those times where everybody thinks that the world is superficially coming to an end, you know, there's huge fear about earnings growth progression or economic growth or what Trump said or whatever it might be, and there's that general pessimism across markets, everything comes down, that's when you get a bit more picky about investments. Pick and choose, find those that are a bit more interesting. You've done the work on them, you know the level that you wanted to buy it at. If you've assumed ceteris paribus, you know, everything else, all other things being equal, and nothing's particularly changed other than market sentiment and a bit of fear and a bit of fear and worry out there, then go for it. You know, that's where having done a bit of work and even being a bit geeky and write down a few share price levels, load them up into a nice system. I'm sure you guys can do it. It will flash when it hits 200 pence or whatever it might do. That's so helpful. And of course, you know, you've got to be greedy when other people are fearful. But doing it is tough. So if you have this is where systems can be useful. A little system saying to you, right, you said you'd buy it when it's 200p. It's here now. has anything really changed? Is it just market sentiment that's moved around? Am I going to do it? And sometimes some of your best decisions can come from those moments.
Hmm. And do you think you'd be an investor? If you had another job, what would it be? You know, because you're so passionate about investing and decision making.
I'm not convinced I'm actually any good at anything else, to be brutally honest. I'm not that I'm, you know, a genius at investment. My goodness, I'm a bit better than average, maybe. But the other aspect, and certainly something I've done a lot more on in the last 5 or 6 years, is I guess it's a function of getting older, is that I seem to be doing a little bit more kind of teaching type things. And I do work with one of my old universities. I do do things like dissertation supervision. You know, when they're writing about companies, it's kind of interesting seeing these, you know, 22-year-olds. It reminds me of back then, you know, doing the master's course, writing about a company. But of course, what they haven't got, they're technically brilliant, absolutely technically brilliant, way better than me, maybe even now, and certainly back then. But what they haven't yet developed, because of, you know, it's just an experience thing, are those range of qualitative skills. So I reckon, and obviously I can sort of help sort of identify some things to look at and things to think about and stuff like that. So I reckon if I did something else, and maybe I'm morphing to it naturally, is that I become some kind of wacko teacher. I'm the crazy teacher who's sort of, you know, always saying back when I did whatever. But actually, it goes back to something I said earlier. If you can explain it and talk about it, it shows you know it. And genuinely, I learn a lot of stuff from actually teaching younger people, because then it shows that I do understand it, but also some of the questions they ask and some of the techniques that they've got in terms of valuation and whatever, it keeps me on my toes as well. So win-win, I reckon.
And how many times do you reckon you tell your students the Bernie Madoff story?
There's an introductory lecture I've done two or three times now, each year's intake, obviously, and it does seem to play a starring role in that for some reason. You know, I guess I could talk about other stories, where I bulked it up, you know, materially, and what I've learned from it. But that's a good story, because even today's, you know, 21, 22-year-olds, they've heard of Bernie Madoff, and it's kind of interesting, and everyone loves a story where I see them always putting themselves in that position and saying, what would I do? Because the pressure at the time was kind of interesting. The pressure was, you know, indirectly from clients. Why are you selling this great investment? But that's what sometimes you've got to do. You know, I'm reminded of the John Paul Getty line of when asked, how do you get rich? He said, by selling too soon. And, you know, I think that is so true. You know, a profit's never a profit until you take it. And even though what happened at Madoff, you know, I could never fully appreciate, I'm kind of glad that the clients that I was responsible for back then at least had an opportunity to get out and do something a bit different with their money.
If you had £10,000 today, where would you put it and why?
So £10,000 today, I would do four things with it. The first thing would be I would buy a couple of good quality UK domestic names. I'd put a bunch of it into the emerging markets, or emerging markets focused or oriented companies or funds, depending on your predilection. I'd invest some in Europe, which I think actually is, I say, rudely perceived at the moment. And with the remaining quarter, because it is a volatile world out there, I keep it back as cash, in order for when the markets fall 10 or 12%, to put it in to double up my favourite positions, which no doubt will have come back a bit with the market, just because that's the way it is. So basically, I think there's three big themes there at the moment: domestic UK, continental Europe, and EM. Bits of all of those, and a bit of dry powder, because I think it's a weirdo treat from a tweet from Trump, something strange in the world. You'll get an opportunity, and you can make a bit of money, you know, putting it in at that time of strife or uncertainty.
Mm. And those are the three things you spoke about.
Precisely, that's right. So, you know, I mentioned a few names that maybe fit into that a little bit, but certainly thematically, that's how I've positioned myself at the moment. You know, I do have some cash of my private pension fund, which I manage myself. Cash levels were 20% at the in late December. I put 10% cash in late December. I've got about 10% cash at the moment. That's broadly unchanged. It's been a bit of in and a bit of out, but broadly that's unchanged since. What would induce me to kind of go all in? It would be sort of a bit of vol akin to what we saw in December or the back end of last year. Would I go all in at that point, all other things being equal? Yes.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us today. If you had three or five or as many takeaway messages that you'd like investors, private investors, or people aspiring to be better investors to take home, what would it be?
So number one would be get your hands dirty. So by that I mean look at company websites, be inquisitive. There's so much information out there that there's no excuse not to look at it. The second thing is only invest in what you know or what you can understand. And obviously what you know is quite a small grouping, but your insights are good. You know, if you're walking down the street and see some retail theme that you think is quite interesting, then do a bit of work on it. That's a good insight. That's a good start. But only invest in things that you feel that you understand. And certainly where I've made mistakes in the past, it's actually overextending that into sectors and areas where actually my knowledge, when I look back, was a bit superficial. So get your hands dirty. You know, invest in things that you truly can understand. Ultimately, number three, write stuff down. That really matters because you can go back to it. You know, just tap a few things up, a few bullet points, clip a couple of key bits, go back to it, learn from it. Writing an investment diary is a bit geekish, but it's quite useful. You know, understanding where you went wrong, good stuff, bad stuff, etc. And linking to that, number four, I would say, is set yourself targets. Targets to buy shares in times of strife, targets to re-review shares if it's gone really well. Don't be shy to put stop losses in and then actually genuinely say, you know, is it a proper stop loss or is it a double or quits moment? You know, for me, typically, maybe let's say I would have a stop loss at or a re-review moment, let's say 10% down. And that would be a, do I double up or do I stop myself out? And then maybe 20% down, i.e., you know, another 10% down from maybe where I've added, it would be maybe a hard stop. Because generally, all your big losses, all your big 80, 90% losses in your portfolio, they start off as 10 or 20% losses, you know, in 99% of cases. So, you know, have stops, have a bit of discipline. Fifth point, enjoy it. You know, if you don't enjoy it, then, you know, there are plenty of wealth managers, passive funds, and other options out there to do. Enjoy it. Look yourself in the mirror at the end of the day and say, I've tried my best with the time and resources available to me. It's been an interesting game, an interesting ride. And, you know, I've done as much as I can do in the investment world. You know, you can become obsessed with it, of course, but the key is to enjoy it. Because ultimately, money is important, but the stories behind money, I reckon, are even more insightful.